Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Judith Hawking, who is part of the ensemble cast of Next Fall, currently playing at Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. Judith is an exuberant, exciting, articulate, interesting, unusual actress. This is a very interesting interview, so hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is simply about being who we really are. It is my belief, as I say in almost every show, that most of us only have a very limited view of who we really are. Of course, there are things about pretty much all of us that we keep secret and we know we're keeping them secret. Maybe somebody tells a joke and you don't get it and you don't tell. Maybe you laugh as though you got it, right? And you pretend that you got it. Or maybe even larger, you know, people are talking about something and you don't understand it, but you don't let them know because you don't want them to think that you're dumb. There are thousands of things that we might decide are not okay. I know my father, who was so smart and who was constantly, as a grown man, in contact with doctors and lawyers and engineers and people with higher education, my father never admitted to the fact that he didn't graduate from high school, had to go out to work quite young. So he kept that fact a secret. No one would have thought less of him for that, because everybody knew how smart he was. And if anything, I think they probably would have been impressed with what he had managed to accumulate in the way of knowledge for someone who hadn't graduated from high school. But my father decided that that was an embarrassing thing that would make people think less of him, and so he kept that a secret. I suspect most of us are keeping those kinds of secrets. These are conscious secrets, things that we know about ourselves but have decided would bring a consequence that we don't want, so we keep them a secret. That's not what I'm talking about when I say that there are things about ourselves that we have kept hidden. These are things which we have kept hidden from ourselves. How can that be? Well, it's easy. It is my belief, as a psychotherapist who's been in practice for more than 30 years, that part of childhood is the desire to please the parent no matter what. It is my experience, understanding, discovery, after all these years of working with people who are in some way in distress, that the primary job of childhood seems to be to please or at least not upset the parent. Do not let mom or dad be upset, angry, scared, distressed, frightened, mad, whatever. So we have antennae for that, the flicker of the eyelid, the drooping of the mouth, the way the shoulders are held. Every slight indication that we have not been approved of, that something has gone wrong. Of course, the raising of the voice, the mean comment, the God forbid trauma or abuse, these things are, you know, or even just the don't do that, or words like who do you think you are, or why, you know, don't cry, it won't help, or you know the litany. All of the ways in which, from the very, very subtle, as I said, sort of flickering of the eyelid, to the very, very dramatic, also, as I said, abuse, children are in no confusion about whether what they have done or who they are is going down well with the parent or not. And for some unfortunate kids, the parent doesn't even make sense. For some, hopefully most, the things the parent likes are clear, and the things the parent doesn't like are also clear, and you get it right away, and so that you can begin immediately to take those things which the parent doesn't like out of your repertoire. But for kids whose parents are alcoholic or ill or under great strain, or had been abused by their own parents, sometimes you get confusing messages, and the thing that worked once doesn't work again, and the thing that brought a storm of upset, the next time it doesn't bring anything. So those kids learn to become hyper-vigilant to the tiniest indication. I've heard I don't know how many kids talk about listening to the tread, the footstep of the returning parent to tell whether it is angry or not, or drunk or not, and then having a series of behaviors that address what they had heard. Do they run to their room and hide? Do they show up at the door with a smile? So what is the point that I'm making here? The overall point is that we learn quite young to control who and what we are, at least who and what we demonstrate, not who and what we are, because we can't do much about that. So, although we learn not to laugh if laughter embarrasses, upsets, or annoys our parent, or not to cry, not to say that we're not feeling well if that brings a storm of bad response, or to say we're not feeling well if that brings on the tenderness and the care and the response that we want. We can learn to turn on and turn off virtually any behavior. There's a studies that show that Jewish children, or for that matter, Catholic children or Gypsy children, learn not to cry by the time they're two, if crying is going to endanger the family. So what happens? You figure it out very, very soon, as soon as you possibly can, that this or that behavior doesn't go down well, doesn't bring the response that you want. And at first, you pretend not to have it. And over time, because the brain is the best labor-saving device ever invented, you forget that you have it. And you grow into adulthood believing that you are someone who never cries, never has the impulse to cry, or rarely smiles or laughs, or is chronically ill, or never admits to illness. I have a client who believes absolutely that she will not be ill. That she, if she gets something that feels like it's not right, she can fix it. She is not going to be ill. This was not allowed in her childhood for her to show any sign of weakness. And the end result of this is that small colds have turned into pneumonia because she wouldn't take it seriously. Over time, she has begun to consider the possibility that this idea about herself was something which she came to in self-defense as a child, but is not serving her today. And that's, of course, the point, that some of what we learned as children certainly protected us in a self-defense way in our childhood and was essential, but may not only not be serving us now, but might be getting in our way, may be endangering us in the way that my client's inability to take her physical condition seriously was definitely endangering her. So, what do you think about yourself? Are you someone who can never assert their interest, can never say I want? A lot of my clients have this one. Absolutely, the mouth will not say I want. And there's all kinds of euphemisms that they might use, but even that is probably difficult. And sometimes I simply have to give the assignment that they say, I want, to get the mouth used to saying it. And even when they're saying it about nothing, you know, they can feel their stomach tighten and their heartbeat speed up. Is this true for you? Are you aware at all of the things that you can't do which would benefit you? Well, that's what the Lynn Show is about first recognizing that it is possible that you were forced in self-defense to deny something about yourself which you could use today, and then to recognize that it didn't go away, that it exists still. I call this having gone undercover, that it is recoverable. However, since there was a huge taboo against using it in the first place, there is still a taboo against using it now. And so, should you believe me? Should you even have some idea of what it is that you are in denial for, to use the technical term? Should you want to access and recover it? Please be gentle with yourself. Please understand that there will almost certainly be consequences, maybe even a price to pay for its recovery. And of course, that's the job of psychotherapy. So you might want to enlist a therapist as you do this recovery work. And if you want to talk to me about that, I do all of my psychotherapy work on the telephone these days. And you can reach me by going to my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne, don't leave the E out of Lynn, show, thelynnshow.com. And when you go up on my website, if you want to talk to me, you can click on contact me and email me and I will get back to you. Or if you have a question, you can do the same thing. I wrote a book about this. It's called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can, I believe, listen to the first chapter of the book online at my website and get access to the book by asking me for it. Also, you can listen to the podcasts of all of my earlier shows. But now, the other thing that I do in my show is interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And today I am doing just that with an interview with Judith Hawking. Judith is particularly interesting because she did not discover her passion, her destiny, her career until the 11th grade. Most of the people, as you will hear her say as she listened to some of my shows before talking to me, most of them say, well, I knew at 2 or 4 in the first grade or the 8th grade. Not Judith. But when she discovered it, she embraced it with all of her heart, as I am hoping that you will do with the things that you have denied. In any case, Judith is a fascinating, interesting human being. And so here she is, Judith Hawking. Okay, so I'm here with Judith Hawking in what looks to be a rehearsal space at FST. And this is a unique opportunity for me because, among other things, I've never interviewed anyone who's heard the show.
Seriously?
Seriously.
I love that.
So this is, it's funny. It's interesting to me because it'll be interesting to see if there's any difference because I always have to explain what I do.
Right.
And you heard a couple of the shows. You know, sure. I'm always saying, well, and such doesn't know what I do, so I'm having to explain.
Sure.
That I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Right.
And here I am explaining it, even though I don't need to.
I have an inkling.
Yes, you do. So then you know, the question I ask and what I want to know basically is, how did it start for you? When did you know you were an actor? Oh, I didn't say. Judith is a very, very fine actor. And I will talk more about that later. But
sure.
But I'm really, that's my interest is, how did it happen? When did you find it?
Right. It's so interesting because I have listened, and people have all these fabulous stories of their aha moment. I don't have an aha moment. I don't have one.
So then let me ask a specific question. When was the first experience of being in theater or acting or performing that you had in your life?
Grade 5. Yeah, you're a good man, Charlie Brown. And I ended up doing Peppermint Patty and just stole the show because, you know, I added things. I mean, I could do anything I wanted, and my parents were very, very supportive in everything, which is, I think, a blessing. And my husband and I are going to adopt. And so that if I can give my kids one gift, it will be that gift of yes.
Yes.
I was thinking, yes. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of, even when it sounded stupid to me, my parents went, okay, yes. Yeah. So it was that, and I did it, and it was really fun. And then I didn't do anything else until I was in grade 11, and then I needed extra credit.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Grell Smith, who I will never forget, very, very respected teacher. And he said, I know you need some credits, why don't you try out for the drama? Or not try out, why don't you just go to, you didn't have to try it for drama, but you just kind of showed up and hoped for the best. And then it was so interesting to me because you got to do all the things I love. You got to find out about other cultures. You were able to get into someone else's skin. You were able to play with others. I mean, I've done 2 one-woman shows. And I think everyone should do a show once because it's lonely. I mean, part of the great thing about being an actor is way more fun when you have people to bounce off. And hopefully you play with people who are better than you. Because I have to say, I feel that I am so blessed in this production. The other actors are phenomenal,
yeah.
And Kate is just a bit of a genius, isn't she?
We need to tell the audience that Judith is here in a production of Next Fall,
yes,
which was directed by Kate Alexander.
Yes.
That's the Kate that she's referring to.
That
right,
is the Kate,
right.
Yes.
And that's the play she's talking about, and mm-hmm. and her ensemble actors that she was referring to.
Who are just terrific, and there are 6 of us, 5 of us are out of New York. Catherine Tanner is local, who is fantastic. So it's really terrific to be able to do that because Every night you go out there and you bring your A game. But there, every night there's moments where all of a sudden you go into that fantastic realm of possibility where you know what you're supposed to do, you know what you're going to do, and it even surprises you.
What's so interesting to me about that character is that for all of whatever the fundamentalist beliefs she has, and for
but
all
I don't think she has fundamental beliefs.
Well, that's where I was going to go. I mean, yes. you expect her to.
Yes.
Because they do, right? But she doesn't.
No.
Right.
And I think
she's a complicated character.
She is.
In her way, maybe the most complicated character in the play.
I think she's the heart of the piece.
Yeah,
I think that, you know, other characters are the head or the soul, the moral compass, the antagonist, however you want to do. I think that, and that's why I took the piece, because I think that she is just wonderful in her complexity, but also in how utterly vulnerable he lets her be.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we're talking about it, and I don't think I thought about this much before, she's the most balanced in the play.
I think she is too. And that's what's so interesting.
Because he gives her all these terrible things, and yet...
Yes.
Right.
But I think she's come to it. And isn't that great? Like, aren't those the most interesting people when you're, well, you know, what was your life? Well, it was an ashram, and then I sold drugs for a while, and then I think those people are fascinating if they come into if they can come through it,
right.
And again, if they do it, if they can find a place where they live with love. And what's interesting is, yes, she abandoned her son, but she came back, and she's there. The stepmom isn't there. She's there.
Right. Right.
To be by her baby's side.
But let's go back to the 11th grade where Judith needs extra credit, so she goes to the drama class.
So I did it. I loved it. And then I had been accepted into one of the best law schools in Canada and sat down and talked to my parents and said, you know what, I think this is what I want to do. And my father said, well, you can always do law. You can always go back to law, which I think was a really...
An amazing thing for him to say.
A really kind, and
yes.
Because he was a very successful executive. My mother was a nurse, so they just thought we should do what we want to do. And I auditioned I graduated early from school, and I auditioned for University of Alberta, which is when I went to school was the place to go. I was too young, they wouldn't let me in. So I went for a year to University of Victoria, did... I don't know, 26 plays in a year, just did everything I could, came back, auditioned. I was still too young, but two of the professors overrode the faculty, and they allowed me in.
So in Victoria, you were studying acting?
Yes. Yes, under Carl Hare, who, again, terrific, terrific acting teacher in Canada.
Okay, so by then, mm-hmm. you had said, this really worked, this really captures me.
No. By then I said, this is a cool
yeah,
thing
Yeah, that's kind
do.
Of interesting. I'll try
right.
to do this.
And
right.
I'm really
right.
good at it.
Right.
And
it's fun. And
it's
why
fun,
not?
And why not?
Exactly.
I mean, again, I'd like to say, when I came out of the womb,
I love this. I love this.
Yeah.
And because it makes the point that you don't have to come out of the womb with whatever it is, you know, that things emerge later in life based either on accidents, happenstance, circumstance, any number of things can trigger something that you didn't know was there.
I agree with that. I also believe, at the risk of sounding phenomenally flaky, I believe that the universe takes care of you. And if you say yes to it, that the universe will say, well, go over here. Maybe go over here. You know, I just think that when you say yes, you allow yourself the naivete of believing in the possible. And I think that's something I've noticed as we get older. Sometimes it's well, but. And maybe is no. I don't care what anyone says. If you say maybe, it's no.
It's not happening.
No, it's no. You have to think about it.
Yeah.
So why not just say yes, unless you really don't want to do it, and then just give a polite, firm no. But why not say yes?
Yeah, I don't think it's naivete. I think it's something else. Maybe... optimism, maybe faith, maybe I can't think of what the word exactly that I mean is, but I don't think it's naivete. I think it is a sense that you're going to be all right.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, so you can take the risk, you can take the chance. If this doesn't, if you say yes and it doesn't work out, oh well, then you'll say yes to something else.
No, I agree with that. The reason I use that word is because it presupposes that you don't have knowledge of what could happen.
Yes.
And I think that that's something that constantly, perhaps, is a lovely reminder to give ourselves.
That you don't have to. I agree entirely. And I do think that most of the obstacles to people being who they are have to do with believing they have to know how it's going to come out.
Absolutely. Perfectionism, I think, is the death of us all. You know, that great idea that when you, the great carpet makers who
put in the
mistake, put in the flaw because only God can make perfection.
Right.
I think there's something lovely about that.
I do.
We don't have to put flaws in our lives. We have plenty of them that will show up, you know?
Yes.
But I think there's something lovely about letting go of the idea that it has to be just so.
Yeah. I agree. And I also think that so much of that perspective comes from the parents who say, uh-oh, be careful, no, don't, what about, and stuff like that, and you didn't have that.
I didn't, but I also believe that everybody does the best they can, and that's another thing that I really believe.
I do too, but the best they can isn't always, you know, this isn't a criticism of people who say that. I mean, I understand they're doing the best they can, but the end result is that lots of people come into adulthood afraid.
Well, I remember doing The Artist's Way, a terrific book, because everyone was doing it, and of course I didn't want to do it, and then I thought, well, if everyone's doing it, it must be something. And I remember feeling like a total and complete failure when they were asking questions. What's the most, remember the questions about your family, like, what's the most horrible memory that you had above it? And I kept thinking, well, remember my father never took me to a Planet of the Apes movie once because I pretended, I was on my bike and I pretended I didn't hear him. You know, I mean, and I'm thinking, it's so funny because, and for a long time I thought, how can I be, it's the idea of the 10,000 hours to become a master. How can I be a master of something if I don't have angst and
that's
deprivation to draw upon?
And but that's the myth of the miserable artist.
Absolutely.
Which I do not buy.
I don't either.
Mm-mm. Well, okay, this is wonderful. I want to rewind a little bit.
Sure.
Because where we have you is that you're playing with this. You're saying yes to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're enjoying it. But you're not in any way committed to it.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say I was 100% committed to it if it worked out.
Right.
So it's like anything, you know, you go skiing down a hill,
you better
be committed to it. Doesn't mean you're going to be a ski instructor or go, you know, try it for the Olympics.
So you were, your heart was in it for as long as,
Yeah. And then I started discovering the classics. And the school that I went to, we did Chekhov, Molière, Racine. In our fourth year, we did The Suicide, which is by Erdman. It's a Russian play that's done in 1923. And all of the women were out of their mind excited because we didn't have to wear corsets. Yeah, it was crazy. So I had a lot of classical training, and I loved that. And I loved the size of it. But I had a lot of very good job offers, and I did some work in Canada, but I looked around at my classmates, and I had the most beautiful, intelligent class in the world. I mean, these people were just terrific. But I looked around, and what I found was that our technique was flawless, and no one moved me. And the play that I'm doing now, next fall, I've had people openly weep when I've been doing something. I've had a woman talk back to me and say, oh, sweetheart.
You're kidding from the audience?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm getting quite a bit of it. It's quite interesting.
Wow.
And it's okay.
Yes, of course.
It's great.
Yes.
And I don't want to say what the end of the play is, but when I do my gesture at the end of the play, we've had wows.
Yeah.
We've had, oh, thank you. You know, it's just been beautiful. And I understand that that's not de rigueur for your audience. They're not really that much of Chatty Cathy's.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to do. And then Gordon Peacock, who was a teacher of mine who ran University of Texas for a number of years after he left Canada, said, go to CalArts. CalArts is the master school that Disney started. It will be, it's all it is five disciplines. It's music, dance, theater, film, and art. And really terrific artists have come out of there. And he said, more so than any other school in America, this is where you need to go to, because Libby Apple's there, Robert Benedetti's there, I mean, really, really great teachers, and they will, you have the technique, but I know what you're saying, so go for a master's. And a master's is the wave of the future. Everyone's going to be needing master's. And it's terrific, because if I choose to teach, and I do seminars, it's, I think teaching is really interesting. I'm very blessed. I've never done anything but act. So I don't have another job. I don't...
You don't have a day gig.
I do not. I never have. So I'm very, very, very blessed to be like that. But I also do a lot of different things. I don't just do the leading lady. The last five films I did, I was head of a nurse in a psych ward, and it was a really kind of a Terry Gilliam Brazilian-esque film. It was fantastic. So I had, you know, white starched uniform on, and I was crazy. I was a psychologist in another one. I was a serial killer in another one. I was a coroner in another one. And all these women look very differently, because I'm very blessed. I have a lot of angles to my face, so I can look a lot of different ways. And if you change my hair color, it completely changes my look. So I'm very, very blessed that way. So I went to CalArts, and it was the best thing I could have done. I thought I was going to have to kill myself the first 6 months in the school. People didn't show up for time on classes. I came from a school where if you were late twice, you were kicked out of the program.
Wow.
Out of the program. Yes, it was based on the British
I think
school
it's great.
System. I do too. Yeah.
Right.
So that, I would say my fourth year, when I really realized that you can change people's lives with your art. You can change their lives. And you don't do it you do it the way Brecht did it. You entertain first and you slip in the message second. Because there's nothing worse than, for me anyway, than watching some boring political diatribe that's supposed to be a play, and it's just some sort
it's
of
thinly
veiled disguise, a lecture of what the playwright wants to tell you. No, the great playwrights write about character. It's character first, and then they give you a very compelling plot, and oh, whoops, isn't that interesting that they slipped that in there?
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I think that it always makes me a little nervous, because I work with a lot of playwrights, when they say, well, you know what I want this to be about? And I'm like, la, la, la. why don't you just decide who's saying what? Why don't you just have great characters?
Right. So, and then it either will or will not communicate what it is you're trying to... Right.
Well, there's a terrific, in New York City, there's a lot of terrific programs and theaters that will work on new plays. New Dramatists is a terrific, terrific place that does it. The Lark Theater is another terrific place that does it. A lot of the smaller companies, New George's, Club Thumb, there's so many of them, you can't even name them all, but they're very... what's the right word? Dedicated, I would say, to making sure that playwrights get what they need. It's not the olden days where you had a stock company and then you could whip out a play and your players would read it. And then you could do it again and then a year later you'd come back to it. Or you could tweak it in the provinces for three months until you got it right. Those days aren't here now. What happens is if you want to do a show in New York now is you do a showcase of it. And if people like it, you move it somewhere else. And if you like it, then you move it somewhere else. So it's, you know, the face of theater has changed quite a bit.
What does that mean to the actor?
I think it means you need to be flexible. Mm-hmm. I think that you, like how I read my books or how I watch my films, I do my plays that way. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing a play because you need a paycheck. Absolutely not. But I think if you only do that, then you get resentful and complacent. I don't think there's anything wrong with going away and doing theater for $500 a week, but you cannot make a living like that if you do that all the time.
You can't make a life out of it.
Well, I think you have to balance. I think you have to balance your artistic needs, and I think that you need to have a good business sense. It is show business. It is theater. And I don't think there's anything wrong with, and again, I think that that's something that should be being taught in the schools too. What do you do with your money? Start putting, sweetheart, if you come out of school and you're 21 and you put 10% away,
right,
from 21, you'll be very happy at 65.
If you open an IRA,
yeah,
at 21,
yes,
you can retire at 50.
Yes.
I know. Nobody tells you.
Well, but they need to. And
right.
So that's when I give, I mean, I'm going to be giving a couple of seminars to the little sweethearts here because they have an acting company here. And it's what I do in...
At FST?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm also going to see if, because I've worked at the Oslo twice. Right out of school, I worked at the Oslo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was great. I did Heidi Chronicles and Bruce Rogers, who is now the head of Hermitage.
Right.
Who, terrific, terrific playwright. I mean, just, he is a phenomenal playwright. And he did a play called Lost Electra, and I did
that
at the Oslo. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important. When I'm in New York, I don't do seminars as much because how I do my community work, as it were, we have two dogs, and they're therapy dogs. So I do stuff where I go to the veterans hospital and visit with the vets, and it's just hysterical because half of them are like, what are you doing here? And the other half are like, that's a girl with lipstick and a dress. You know, they could care less about the dogs. And then a couple of them actually like the dogs. But when I'm on the road, I feel it's really important because I do think the way that we become stronger as a community is the elders help. And by elders, if you've been in this business longer than 10 years and you've survived and you're doing it, then you're considered an elder. And you should be helping the little ones who are coming up.
Giving back.
I think so.
I agree. And I also think that that's another one of the things, another one of the values that we don't see that much of anymore.
But it's taught. It's like anything. Manners are taught, you know. But you don't say to a little sweetheart, you know, shut the fuck up. You say, sweetheart, please don't do that. And there's too much of the former in our culture now. If you tell the kids here, help one another. I mean, don't be dumb about it. If you know that you're going up for a part and you're great for it, and your best friend looks exactly like you and might get the part, I don't think that's required. No, it's not. However,
right.
If you know something that can help someone and it won't harm you, absolutely tell them. I think you absolutely should.
I don't know, this is harkening back to something you said just a little bit ago about shut the fuck up.
That'll be our catchphrase.
Yeah, right. I see too many plays where people are gratuitously cruel to each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big mistake. And I don't know why people do that.
It sells.
You know I'm a therapist if
yes.
you listen to that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't know how much time I have spent helping couples not be unkind and cruel to each other.
Yes.
And one of the reasons that they do it is because they see it mm-hmm. everywhere, you know. And I think you don't need to do that to make the point that you're
Absolutely.
Making, you know?
Absolutely.
So you think it's just that is somehow attractive to people and that's why people write like that?
I don't think it's attractive. I think what it is we are moving into a really interesting era. And we're, because of, and I tease people, and they can be in their 30s, they can be 17. I tease them all the time. Your face is always in a computer, or your face is already always in a phone. You're always, I think multitasking is the biggest bullshit going. I don't think anyone can multitask successfully. What it does is you do five things so-so.
Right.
You don't do anything
really
with excellence.
Well, right.
You don't.
Right.
I don't know any artist. I mean, I would doubt very much that Michelangelo was going, hey, Tony, so let's talk about, you know, what happened at the Vatican.
Right.
You know, I mean, I just don't think that
right.
was happening.
Right. Right.
There's a reason artists have studios. There's a reason actors have rehearsal halls. I mean, if I had it my way, there'd be no electronic devices allowed in rehearsal halls, in theaters, backstage. There just wouldn't be, because I think it takes the energy away. More than that, I think what it does is it lets you look at everything from a certain distance.
Yes.
And if you allow yourself to distance,
yes.
then you don't have to be engaged. And if you're not engaged, then you don't have to be as responsible. So you can say whatever it is you want, and it's clever and pithy, and it can be hurtful, but it's not that bad. Because you didn't really mean it. Because you didn't really invest in it. So it's just words. And I do think that words are important. What we say about ourselves and to ourselves is important, and what we say to other people is extraordinarily important.
Yes, of course. You know, when I was growing up, it was that, you know, sticks and stones,
sure,
right? But words will never hurt me. But this is...
Words are all we have now.
That's right. Well, and it's blatantly untrue.
Like the bullying on the Facebook or
that's
whatever
right,
happens.
Right.
It's
or in
all
school.
About the words.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there's, do you know who Benjamin Zander is? He's a conductor. He wrote a beautiful book called The Art of Possibility.
Mm.
And it's about the artist, and it can be an actor, it can be whatever. And it's a beautiful book. Michelle Lowe, who's a very, very, very good playwright. I did one of her plays, Victoria Musica. I either do classics or I do new plays. It's very interesting now. It's very, very interesting because I did 8 years of nothing but classics. Then I did nothing but new plays. And now they're kind of, you know, switching back and forth. And then there's, you know, films which are always new or TV which is always new. So it's all very exciting. But he writes a lot about how you live in your world and how you choose to live in your world. Because it is a choice. And I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm not saying there are days where somebody will do something and I don't choose the kindest way. But I'd like to believe that probably about 90% of the time I do, just because I've chosen to live my life like this, but for a very long time. In my 20s, I don't think I cared quite as much about the emotional footprint I was leaving on the universe, as it were. You know, I did
but,
not
you know,
care.
Actually, I think that's... I've never heard anybody quite say that. Maybe it's very common, and I don't know. But the idea of the emotional footprint, I think that's exactly right. That it is not... It isn't that it goes by and it doesn't mean anything or it doesn't continue to live on. It does.
Well, it's all energy.
Yes,
it's
that's
all
right.
energy. I mean,
that's
I'm,
right.
Yes, I'm another thing, you know, of all the things you could be, I mean, I would never be anything but an actor because I'm good at it and I like it and it makes me happy, but there's a million other things I'm interested in. And physics happens to be one of them, and the new physics and what's going on there. What I think is so interesting is it just keeps coming back to the same thing, that it's all cause and effect.
Yes.
It's all cause and effect.
And you can't escape it.
You cannot escape it.
That's right. You're
and
either the cause or you're the effect.
Right.
But you're on one side of it or the other, and there's no way to distance from that.
Well, I think what's confusing, though, especially if you're 21 and should only be concerned about yourself, because at 21 I think that's the way the world works. I think the thing you don't realize, though, is it is cause and effect, but just like any other law that is a metaphysical law, it doesn't necessarily have to be instantaneous.
The effect?
Yes.
Oh, no, I
and
think
And I think that's what's interesting, too.
Yes,
you get
right.
away with things a certain while, and then you wonder why all of a sudden it catches up with you in a month, or 10 years, or 20. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't even catch up with you, because, I mean, look at our fabulous tycoons in America. I don't know, did it ever catch up with them? I mean, do you really think that the Carnegies and the Rockefellers of the world went to their graves thinking, oh, you know, I shouldn't have built that house and busted the unions and killed over 1,000 people. You know, I really do regret that. I mean, maybe if there was Catholicism running through that and they knew they could repent and then go, you know, one-way ticket up. I think your hell and heaven is what you make it. That's what I honestly believe. I think it's here. I think it's now.
Well, whether that's true or not, I don't know whether this is true. Maybe I don't know whether this is just what I want
to believe.
Right. If you treat people like they're objects, mm-hmm. you have to be lonely. Whether you have awareness of that loneliness or not.
Right, that's presupposing that you have awareness, though. I don't think that...
No. You don't have to have awareness of your loneliness, but loneliness is painful whether you know what it is or not. So I suspect that people who can be cruel without...
remorse?
Thank you, exactly. Pay a price that may not be visible. That we may not see.
And I think that might be true, and I think for me, the long and the short of it is, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not here to change anybody's mind about anything. The only thing that I can do is give my gifts, and if you want to receive them, that's terrific. And if they somehow can change you, that's terrific. I mean, I remember doing Children's Hour, and I love that play. I love that play, especially if it's done well. That's a well-made play. I mean, you know, Miss Hellman knew what she was doing in all of her plays. But I remember doing that play and getting a letter. And I've, in my career, I've been, I think, very fortunate. Done a lot of work, but a lot of different type of work. And I have had many letters over my career where somebody has written me and said, I changed my mind about something. Or this particular one was a man who wrote me, his wife had killed herself. And in the play, in the end of Children's Hour, I played Martha, I killed myself. And he said, I never realized how much pain she must have been in. And I saw how much pain you were in, and there was no other choice for you to make. Now, I don't necessarily know whether that is true or not, but the fact that he was able to forgive his wife because a piece of theater moved him.
Right.
Now, he was ready to forgive her. I'm not so... I mean, I'm not in the place where I think that I had... I was just the vessel for that. And that gets a, you know, Gloria Swanson said this great thing, silent film star, she said this great thing to a group of women. She said, remember, girls, you're not just a vessel. Because, you know, when she was doing stuff, it was just woman as object. I think there's another way to be a vessel, though, where you can be filled up. And then what happens with that is what happens with that. And if somebody chooses to partake of that, that's terrific. And if they don't, that's okay too. And so I think that that's really important, because the actors, actresses, actors that I really admire are smart and generous and kind and have wicked senses of humor.
Yes.
All of them do. Do you know what I mean? You could just sit and have a few drinks and just have a great time.
Yes.
But I am a big proponent of Lost Horizon or Shangri-La,
mm-hmm.
where the idea is everything in moderation. And I really believe that. And there's a great passage in the book, and they've just restored the film. I don't know if you know that.
Oh,
it was Frank Capra's film.
Yes.
Right? They just restored the part where the monk is talking to him about war, and what they've done is it's a still picture you see, but you see, you hear the dialogue that's underneath it. It's absolutely fantastic. But one of the things I remember that the film caused when it came out was a flop, and then was caused quite a stir because it just came out at the wrong time because of the war that was going on. But you're in a garden, and the down pilot asks the monk, well, what do you mean moderation? He said, in all things, drink, but drink a little. You know, have food, but don't eat to gluttony. And I really believe that. And then he says, and what about adultery? And the monk says, all things in moderation. And I kind of like, you know, Todd, just kidding, that's my husband. But I kind of love that idea that I think that where we get into trouble is when the rules are absolute.
Yeah, rigidity.
There's common sense, and then there's sometimes you have to say yes to the universe, or sometimes it's just a different path you take for a while, and then you come back. And I think that that's important. I think that's important not to say, well, I'm an actor and I do this kind of work, so I could never, or, I mean, it's all about ego too. It's what will you allow your ego to be in control of?
What do you mean?
Okay, for instance, this year I was very, very sick. I had a virus in my lungs. So I was very, very sick. I mean, extremely sick. And I had to not act for 8 months because I was in and out of hospitals, and it was bad. Well, I was on prednisone. And prednisone, which I had the best, pulmonary guy. He was an East Indian doctor, Dr. Gupta. And I came in. And he said, oh, Judith, you're very, very pretty. And I was, well, thank you, Dr. Gupta. And he said, no more after the prednisone. And I said, excuse me? And he goes, oh, Fatty 2x4. Oh! And I said, what do you mean? He said, Jerry Lewis, Moonface. That's going to be you, dear one.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, oh, well, you know.
Yeah, right.
40 pounds later. Just what happens. It's just what happens. You go prednisone for over 3 months, and it protects you because it's a steroid, and, you know, it does. So it was really interesting when I got this role. I thought, I am 40 pounds heavier than I have been ever, so do I want to be on stage?
Wow.
Well, I'd done a show in New York before that, but it was a genius costumer, and I was in all these fantastic gowns, so I looked like $1 million, and I thought, Arlene is a jeans, and, you know, so I took the role, and it was really interesting because the first day I saw myself in jeans, I didn't know what I was going to do.
Wow.
And then I thought, you are where you are, and maybe this is who Arlene is. So it was good. It was, you know, so that was the
thing. Oh, no, it was great. It works for the role.
Yeah.
Well, I think...
No, but what I was going to say about ego is that I think what ego can do is the way you think the world should be and the way the world is because of your own preconceptions. And I think what really great artists do is either recognize their preconceptions or try to change the world.
So recognize their preconceptions
and
say essentially to themselves, well, that's your preconception. That's not necessarily the truth.
Absolutely.
It's just your preconception.
Absolutely.
Or they say, my preconception is the truth and I'm going to change the world to accept it.
Yep. Okay, here's a few things I wanted to say.
Oh, okay.
One is, my sister was a therapist for years. So she did psychological profiles of my characters. Yeah. And what's great about that is she reads it from the point of view of what the needs, psychoses, whatever, of the character is. So it's fantastic. So I can think, oh, they're misunderstood. And she's like, they're crazy batshit. And it's really awesome.
So what do you think about Arlene from a psychological point of view? Have you got one?
Yeah, sure. She's unbelievably damaged. She's racked with guilt.
One of the things you don't get there is any information about how that happened to her. You know.
You don't need it.
Well, some of us might like it.
Yeah, no, me too. But I wasn't there when he was writing the play.
No.
If I was, there would have been more about her in it.
Right.
But no, I think what's so interesting is a woman came up to me after the play, and she said, you know, she's going to be okay, meaning the character Arlene. And I said, I think she's too. She said, oh, she's really going to have to take care of Butch.
Right.
I thought, you know, who's the husband.
Yeah, right.
And I thought that was so sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And then a man and a woman came up to me after the play. They're very sweet here. I really like the audiences. They're very smart.
Mm-hmm.
Very smart. And they said, did you know that you dropped your voice during the play? I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, when you come out, you were higher. And by the end of it,
it's
like, you were lower. And I said, yeah, I do. No, I did that. But thank you for that. And he was a psychiatrist. And he said, you know, because that's her true voice. She found her voice in the play. And I thought, thank you.
Oh, it's lovely. That's
yeah, it was lovely. Nice. It was, you know, and it's what I had intended. But
and it's
always,
accurate.
Well, it's like when Glenda Jackson did Doll's House. She started the first act, way up here. And then the second, she's kind of, you know, she's figuring these. And by the time she left, she was there. And it's fantastic. It's, you know, and she worked that out. She worked that out. And what I think is really interesting is that your work should be invisible. Your work should be flawless and seamless. I don't think you want to see the technique. You don't want to see the artistry. You just want to be lost in the character.
Yeah, you wanted to speak to the unconscious, and I think that's exactly what you do.
But unless you do the work, and I mean a lot of work, I get up in the morning, I do my meditation, I do my work, and I feel very, very lucky to be able to do my work. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't days where I want to throw something across the room because I can't crack something. But what greater problem to have than to try to crack a code? I believe that I am blessed to be able to do this.
This is a great place to stop.
Thank you. Thanks
Thank
so much.
Thank you so much.
Blessed to do this. Absolutely. And when you see her on stage, you know that it is a blessing. I'm hoping that as you were listening to Judith and listening to the evolution of her discovery of herself, that maybe you also thought, wow, maybe there is something deep inside of me that I haven't discovered yet. Maybe I haven't been as lucky as Judith for someone to point me in the direction of that as early as the 11th grade, but maybe it's still in there for me to discover and for me to recover so that I too can think that my life is a blessing. That's, of course, what I am hoping all of you are hearing when you listen to The Lynn Show. And you can hear in Judith the exuberance, I keep using that word, you know, the joy, the energy, the passion that is connected to her work and to the way that she lives her life, which is to be the Judith she really is. So, let me now, as always, as I'm running out of time, thank Josh Hackney, who, as I say pretty much every week, without whom there would not have been a show, and there would not continue to be a show, because one of the things I can't do is remember the technological things that Josh taught me. And so I have no shyness anymore about admitting the fact that even though I have learned it, I sometimes forget it. And Josh rushes to the rescue and saves me. And so if you have any difficulty with things like recording, engineering, computer, anything computer, then you want Josh Hackney, and you can get him as you can get me at my website, thelynshow.com. Remember not to leave the E out of Lynn. And as always, I am hoping you got something you could use from this show. Something that inspired you, or just something that taught you something you didn't know. Judith knows so many things. Or just something that interested you, something that'll bring you back. Because next week I will be here, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face. And figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Fiend